South Pole, trapped in that Earth's magnetic field. The bad news is that Van Allen belt, if you put a human being there, you're cooking him with a lot of radiation. The good news is it's giving us a lot of protection. A lot of particles that come from the sun, come from cosmic rays and whatever, they hit that magnetic field in that Van Allen belt, and they get stopped. And the few that get through that, they hit the atmosphere, most of them get stopped. So we're getting a lot of protection down here because of magnetic field, atmosphere, and Van Allen belt. Let me drop. The Van Allen belt on Jupiter, I think I read the number that it's something like 10 million times stronger in radiation than the Van Allen belt around the Earth. 10 million times stronger. I think I read that number. As such, the computer on Juno is a special computer. I think it's called the RAD-750, or is it RAD-75, one or the other. It's a specially made computer made to tolerate high amounts of radiation and keep on cranking. I think they said it runs at either 100 or 200 megahertz clock rate. Not a super fast computer, but it's a very rugged, radiation-hardened computer. That computer itself is put into this coffin. It's a titanium box, 1 centimeter wall thickness, and I think that box weighs something like 500 pounds. All the vital electronics, computer and whatever, is inside that box. Because that radiation belt, the Van Allen belts around Jupiter, are something like 10 million times stronger than our radiation belt. As such, those particles in that Jupiter radiation belt, boy, they want to penetrate anything and mess it up. You put the high-speed microscopic or atomic-sized particles, highly charged, moving at numbers like a few million miles an hour, you put those particles into your computer, and you're going to be unhappy. So lots and lots of shielding is required. This is the most severe environment that the planet Earth has ever launched a piece of electronics into. Let me drop it. So that's part of how they're going to protect it. Now, the dish itself, assuming that the dish is roughly 10 feet in diameter, because the spacecraft is 11 and a half, and the dish looks like it's most of that diameter, I think the dish is in the vicinity of 10 feet. And the communication from the spacecraft back to Earth, one of the main communication channels on the Unified Space Network, not Unified S-band, but Unified X-band in this case, is around 8.5 gigahertz. So you take 10-foot diameter parabolic dish, and you use that rule of thumb I've talked to you about, number of wavelengths divided into 70 degrees and so on, but I've got a program that does the whole calculation. A 10-foot diameter dish at 8.5 gigahertz, let me drop it, has a calculated gain, a 60% aperture efficiency, calculated gain of 46.4 decibels, beamwidth of 0.8 degrees. Plus or minus 0.4 degrees is a half power beamwidth of that dish. Better aim that satellite to the nearest tenth of a degree at the Earth if you want to get all the benefit of that high-gain antenna. And with that high-gain antenna, you get such a strong signal back on Earth that you can now transmit pictures and data at megabyte rates, as opposed to when you're talking to Voyager, which is a lower power spacecraft, a hell of a lot further away. You have to talk to it at 50 bits per second, a very slow data rate, because the signal is so weak. Let me drop it. So this dish on Juno, rough and rough thumb, has got 46 dB of gain. What does 46 mean? If it had 30 dB of gain, 30 dB is a 1,000 to 1 ratio. 40 dB is a 10,000 to 1 ratio. 43 dB would be 20,000. 46 dB is 40,000. So in other words, if I had a small antenna, like a little ground plane antenna, operating at 8.5 gigs, and I transmit a signal with it, and you and I stand a couple of miles away and we pick up that signal, and then you switch over to this 10-foot diameter dish with 46 dB of gain, the 1-watt signal you transmitted with that ground plane will now look like a 40,000 times stronger. It'll look like a 40,000 watt signal. 40,000 to 1 is the gain ratio of that antenna because it's got an extremely sharp pencil beam with 8 tenths of a degree. Good news, it's got a lot of gain. It's going to give you a strong signal. The bad news is, boy, you better be able to aim it real precisely. Otherwise, the signal's going to miss the Earth and you got nothing. So when you give that satellite, let me drop it. You give that satellite and make depth measurements, and it's gonna look at Jupiter at X band, at KU band, a whole bunch of different frequencies. It's gonna make various radar-like probings of Jupiter, looking at the passive noise, aurora noise, ultraviolet signals, and do some radar bouncing of signals off Jupiter. It's gonna do all kinds of things. But you give it a command, or maybe it's programmed. It's got a command to at this period of time, when we pass by the north pole of Jupiter, make these measurements by aiming the dish at Jupiter. And now record everything you got. And now come back and aim the dish at the Earth and download that signal to us. You better hope it very accurately comes back down to aiming that signal back at Earth and to the nearest tenth of a degree, if you don't want to lose a lot of that signal. Fancy chunk going on here. Can you imagine an antenna that takes whatever power you put into it, and because it aims the signal so precisely, such a narrow beam, it makes the signal look 40,000 times stronger. 1 watt in will look like 40,000 watts coming out of effective isotropic radiated power. That's an antenna. WS2N, K2RIW, over to you, Paul.
I'm looking at the deep space network net now, and I was looking at her at the beginning of the net as well. By the way, the titanium wall is one inch thick, and the whole setup is ridiculous. Yeah, they said 400 pounds. That's the weight of the vault. The whole spacecraft itself is around 7,000. So. But, you know, look at the solar panels. Like I said, they weigh 750 pounds. So, gives you an idea what the Atlas V with five booster rockets attached to it could put up there. Put it all the way to Jupiter. Actually, did a flyby of Earth first, and then it went off to Jupiter. But the Deep Space Network, it's showing now. Two of the antennas in Canberra are copying it, and in the beginning of the net, Goldstone, they were on Goldstone, but now the Earth is turned, so they dropped off, and now it's Canberra. Showing 135, yeah, minus 135 dB at 8.4 gigahertz. So, what does that translate to? They have the number here, 2.85 times 10 to the minus 20. So, but minus 135, if you go to, let's say, Voyager 1, I think it's minus 145 plus, around 145. It's only 10 different. Doesn't sound like much, does it, Dick? Back to you.
Yeah, Paul, on your next transmission, tell us the email address of your favorite website to monitor NASA when an event like this burn is going to take place. That's question number one. The vault itself, the coffin or the vault where the radiation protection of all the electronics is on the inside. I found one website that called it an inch thick. I found another website that said it's 1 centimeter thick. 2.5 centimeters per inch, so is it 1 centimeter or 1 inch? Well, if we know the approximate dimensions of the vault, width, length, and height, and we know it's made primarily out of titanium, and you and I can look up what is the density of titanium, grams per cubic centimeter, we can therefore calculate which it's got to be to come out with 400 and some odd pounds. It's either 1 centimeter wall thickness or 1 inch wall thickness. I think 1 centimeter sounds a little bit more a reasonable call. I know the degree of difficulty of machining and elfing and molding titanium. It's huge. Let me drop the Lockheed Company, the Skunk Works, when they had to develop the techniques for refining and shaping titanium to make the SR-71 airplane, they went through hell. It took very special tooling to be able to make those chunks of titanium for those wings in the right shape. Very difficult. So, make titanium 1 inch thick. That may be another breakthrough to do that. So I think the 1 centimeter might be the real number, Paul. When it comes to single strength, Voyager, I think you said it was -145 dBm. Maybe that's the number. The weakest signal I've ever listened to with Morse code reception is something around -145. And I'm using the tone reception capability of my human ears, which have something like a 70 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth. So therefore you can do numbers like that. Very poor signal to noise ratio, if you know what I mean. And that signal from Voyager is so far away and so weak. That's why you've got to send signal at the numbers like 50 bits per second. So when it comes to the signal strength of Juno, run that by again, because I missed that number. And also tell us your favorite website that you monitor when you're monitoring a major event like this one on Juno. WS2N, K2RIW, you got a call.
Yeah, 130, -135 dBm, and I just went over to New Horizons. I got picked up by Madrid, Spain, is showing 142, -142, and of course Voyager is a lot further than that. So yeah, well, NASA of course is the best website, NASA.gov, and go to www.nasa.gov, and they always have the headlines, and they'll have like half a dozen different stories, and as the days go on, the headline story will drop down to the second place, and then eventually the third place, that type of thing. And as far as actually watching the event itself, yeah, you have to bring up NASA TV, and you can get that by, you know, different devices are going to, you know, do it differently. So go to NASA.gov and put in TV, or you can even search in Google, put NASA TV, and sometimes you'll get the proper download for your device. It'll say something. Sometimes it'll say we detected that you have this, or, you know. You know how it is, and you click on it, and then you got an app on a phone. I have it on my tablet, and of course I have it on my computer. So I click one click, and you know, the second I click it, it comes right up. So you got to look for whatever works for you.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But just put a NASA TV on your computer, and I'm sure you'll get it. And then save it to favorites, or if it's an app, save it. Let me drop it. So, interesting when you look at the different satellites that this deep space network is looking at. For instance, Juno right now, they pretty much don't want to transmit to it. They have it on orbit. I heard, I think, as of Thursday. So, you know, you see the waves leaving the antennas on all these different antennas. And when it's just one signal either going up or going down, you just see one wave going back and forth as if it was either entering or leaving the antenna, the dish antenna. And then when, you know, it's like working duplex right now. It looks like it's working duplex with Juno. You have a signal going up and a signal going down. You see two of them. But sometimes you'll see one antenna working two spacecraft at the same time. One was on before MAVEN. You know, that's the NASA the spacecraft that's orbiting Mars. And then there was another one at the same time. I think it was DAWN. And you'll see like four different ones going up, or three if one just getting a received signal and not a transmit signal, you'll see that one, and plus you'll see the other two for the other spacecraft. I don't know if you ever noticed that, Dick. Back to your WS class.
Yes, I think I've seen that call. When it comes to Voyager number one, what is your memory of the weakest signal you've seen from it in the downlink? I think it sometimes hits numbers like minus 155 dBm. Is that true, Paul?
Voyager is up. It's going to come up soon on a, it's like a gold zone. But it's not receiving right now, so I can't see what it is. But if it pops up, I'll let you know. I'll write it down. We'll go over it during the week or next week. But I remember seeing 145 somewhere. That might have been on Voyager 2. 2 is closer. You know, Voyager 1 is actually further away. So, okay, Dick. That's pretty much it for the space portion of the net. But you can stand by for more questions. I know Dawn. Remember you asking, does Dawn have enough power to leave Sirius? That just came out. That was, I think, yesterday's news. There were some people, they managed to really budget the fuel on Dawn, and they now actually have enough fuel to leave Sirius to go somewhere else. And there's a place called 145 Adelina, I think it is. Wrote it down somewhere. Just put an A. And a lot of scientists wanted to go, deorbit Sirius and go there. But they made a final decision now. They're going to stay in Sirius, and that's it. Not going anywhere else. They're just going to do more science at that asteroid. But that, let me drop it. That was the first spacecraft really to go around one orbiting body and then leave and go to another orbiting body. First, it went to Vesta, roughly a 300-mile diameter asteroid. Left it after about a year and a half and went to Sirius, which is a lot bigger. It's probably twice the size, and it's been in orbit ever since, the last year and a half. And it keeps getting lower and lower on purpose to get closer and closer measurements. I remember you asking a couple of years ago, the plan at that time was not to leave Sirius, and when I realized they had enough fuel, the whole problem started is they did have some kind of a fuel problem, I don't know if it was a leak in one of the thrusters or something, and that's why they didn't have enough fuel. This is for keeping it oriented, one way or the other. They don't need that fuel to deorbit or orbit, but they needed to, stay stabilized to point in different directions for different science reasons. To leave and to enter orbit, they don't use those thrusters anyway. They just use the Xeon fuel because they have the ion engine on board. Actually, they have three ion engines on board. Back here, the WS1.
Paul, when Dawn went first in orbit around Vesta and later on left Vesta and went in orbit around Sirius, how much of that orbital insertion and leaving orbit, how much of that was done with the ionic engine versus the chemical thrusters? Is it possible to use the ionic engine for most of the operation by slowly spiraling in and slowly spiraling out? Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
Yeah, that's right. The ion only. The hydrazine nitrogen tetroxide engines are just used for maneuvering. What do they call it? Station keeping. But yeah, to get in and out of the orbits, they only use the ion engines. They'd start with this big long orbit and eventually, slow themselves down further and further. That's what they keep doing now to go into a lower and lower orbit on Sirius. And they think they figure out what that bright shiny thing is on Sirius. That's some kind of salt deposit that was hit by an asteroid. Something hit it at one time, creating a depression, and that got the ball rolling and some kind of activity underneath the surface pushed this salt-like object or material, not one object, but material to the surface. And there's a couple of those spots on Sirius. And now they think that's the whole reason behind it. What they're surprised about is that they didn't know it had any you know, active ability to do that, push something from the inside out. But, they did have a science report on that. That was about a week or so ago, and then all of a sudden they came out with this other thing that they decided to stay there. That was, I think, released yesterday or the day before. I'd be a different.
So I understand you correctly, Dawn is not going to leave Cirrus and go to the 145 Adelino or whatever it was, other space object, asteroid, I guess, we're talking about here. Juno, I think, throughout much of the mission, has been rotating on axis something like 1 RPM. And I believe one of the reports I read is that they're going to speed it up to something like 5 RPM before they do the burn. The whole idea of doing a rotation is that it's sort of like what you do with a rifle bullet. When you rotate it around the axis, it becomes more stable. It becomes a kind of a gyroscope. So even if the rocket engine is not giving its thrust directly through the mass center of the spacecraft, where ordinarily it would start it tumbling, you're rotating around that axis, then it almost negates any misalignment or mass concentration calculation of the spacecraft. But because that burn has to be done so precisely, I think I read they're going to speed it up to 5 RPM of rotation before they do the burn. So there's a whole lot of things that have got to go right for this thing to come out right. When it comes to the launching of the James Webb Space Telescope, which is going to go out there a million miles away from Earth, with a very complicated deployment, very similar situation. A hell of a lot of things have to go just right, where you create a very large, very expensive piece of space junk. I think you and I are going to do a little bit more checking on that vault on Juno. I think it's 1 centimeter thick. To make a titanium box 1 inch thick, I don't think that's possible. Well, it's so difficult. I did read 1 centimeter on the most authoritative report that I remember reading, so I think we got a 1 centimeter versus a 1 inch discrepancy on that box. And I think you said it's 400 some odd pounds. So, do you remember reading that it's going to spin up to something like 5 RPM before the burn pool? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I think I said that earlier on, but it's going to go from the one axis, 1.4 RPMs, that was the cruise revolutions per minute, you know, from when it was launched in 2011 to now. And they have thrusters that are going to start that rotation going and bring it up to 5, and eventually it's going to go back, you know, they're going to reverse. It's not going to stay that speed during its science missions. So, then I just want to go back one step to the asteroid. It was called Adiona, A-D-E-O-N-A, 145 Adiona. I remember looking up the pronunciation of that. And, that's now a dead issue. Some scientists aren't happy about it. They wanted to go see this thing. They would have gotten out there in 2019, so 3 years down the road they could have taken a look at this thing. And it would have been a flyby. See, they weren't going to go into orbit around Adiona. Just a flyby. So they got voted out. They want more science on Sirius. Now, was there another question? I think I lost you. I might have lost the question. Back to you.
Yeah, the only other thing we're discussing is 1 centimeter of vault thickness versus 1 inch of vault thickness. Did you remember 1 inch of wall thickness on that vault, Paul? That out of titanium, solid titanium, which I think you said also has a gold covering in order to get good RF connection on the cover of your ball, K2IW.
Yeah, some kind of an alloy. I thought it was mixed with the gold or something. Read this about a month or two ago, so I'll have to look for it. But I know titanium is supposed to be very light. extremely lightweight, and you know, like an aluminum type of material. Very strong, and that's why it made sense to me. I could see 1 inch. The vault itself is supposed to weigh 400 pounds. That's a lot of weight. So I could see something, you know, built like that. Now, I haven't seen that. Although, wait, I think I did see an exploded view of what the electronics area looks like. They got all the computers in there and everything. But I don't remember the size. I'll have to go back. It was a PDF file. They're usually pretty good. And it was from NASA, so. But I don't know if that was the... I don't think they mentioned the thickness of it. We'll look into it. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was 1 inch. Very light stuff. Back to you guys.
Titanium has a very high strength to weight ratio. In many cases, you can use a very thin sheet of it to develop all the strength you want. But is it a light material? It's got a very high atomic number. So I don't remember the atomic number of titanium. But the atomic number and the mass density, pounds per, grams per cubic centimeter, usually are a one-to-one relationship, because 99% of the mass of an atom is the number of protons and neutrons you've got in the nucleus. The nucleus is 99.9% of the weight, the mass. So titanium is a fairly high atomic number. It's not number 16 like oxygen, if you know what I mean. It's a much higher number. Therefore, it's got to be massive. And if you're using shielding, you want to use a material that has a lot of mass. Otherwise, you don't stop those nuclear particles. So we may be confusing mass of titanium and strength to weight ratio. We've got to do some more checking on all of the above. You sure you remember 1 inch wall thickness? I remember going back and finding it. It did say 1 centimeter wall thickness on the pole. Over to you, K2IW.
Yeah, it was definitely 1 inch. I was impressed by that. Now I just can't remember out of the many different places I've looked at these things, including magazines. I don't remember where I got it from. There's a number of good websites. I'm not all that crazy about space.com. They hype up things, but a couple of other good ones. Spaceflight Insider is very good. Spaceflight Insider. They also give you a lot of information about the rockets and stuff. And sometimes when there's a rocket launch that NASA is not doing, for instance, European Space Agency or maybe SpaceX is launching a private rocket, a private satellite for a different company or a country even. Nothing to do with NASA. NASA will not televise it. But this one website, Spaceflight Insider, many times, not 100% of the times, but many times will transmit. They'll have a guy there, and they'll be interviewing people from NASA or from Boeing or someplace. And pretty good. And, you go to that website, and there's something that's televised. You click on that, and it usually comes right up on the computer. That's how I get to see some of the flights that NASA does not cover.
Give me an example of a flight that NASA does not cover if it's a NASA vehicle that pulls ahead. Is it because it's somehow they thought it was uninteresting or it's classified? It's part of a military operation of your boat?
Yeah, well, I'd say half the flights that go up are NASA flights, and the other half could be like an NRO flight. They had a National Reconnaissance Orbit flight, Space Flight Insider televised on computer. And it was an Atlas rocket, and very cool to watch. But NASA will not televise that. SpaceX has launched many flights for SLS. SES is the name of the company that puts all these geosynchronous satellites up in space. They had SES 9 not too long ago, SES 7 and 8. I'm trying to think of the name of them. Thailand had a launch that SpaceX put up for them, and they launch out of Cape Canaveral, Launch Complex 41. SpaceX controls that. There's been flights out of, I think, the Cassiopeia flight from Canada that flew out of Vandenberg Air Force Base was not a NASA flight. If NASA has an interest in it, for instance, the Discover mission, that was a combination. People that were paying for that was NASA, the Air Force, and what was the third group? I'll think of it. There were three groups, three entities involved in that. So since NASA had a piece of it, that was televised. And that was the one that went out to an L1 position. It happens quite a bit. I have never seen him go to a foreign country. If a Progress vehicle is launched or the upcoming Kate Rubin flight with the Soyuz spacecraft this Thursday at roughly 9:30 at night, that will definitely be televised by NASA. So you got to look for these things, Dick. You got to remember, less than half the flights that are going up in the world, less than half now are probably NASA. Back to you.
Let me toss it up to the group listening. This is the space report section of the TechNet. This happens to be space report number 207 that you're listening to, connected to TechNet report number 1608. And by the way, I saw on Newsday last Sunday that the Total Howdy Doody show, the very first children's show of national application, started in 1947 and ran for 13 years until 1960. A total of 2,343 shows, I think it was. 2,343.
Repeater, time out.
But throughout most of those years, Howdy Doody was on every single day, and eventually at the end was only on Saturdays. So they ran up a bigger number than the TechNet has, and they did that in 13 years, because we only do it once per week. That for 1982, I think is the number. So going on this coming September, it'll be 34 years, TechNet, essentially every single Sunday. I think there was only about two or so interruptions when I was in the hospital. That's a very long-running program. So the space report is going on right now. Anybody's got any further questions for Paul on any spacecraft, give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I remember one time he was going to make it. I think he was stuck up in Utica or something, Dick.
That sounds right. There was a late arrival because I didn't come back from Utica when I went up there with Bruce and 2LIV, Bruce Wood, and I used to go to a lot of flea markets in places like Rochester and Utica and New Hampshire, occasionally Maine, down to Maryland. The Timonium flea market in Maryland is another very big one. I've only been to Dayton twice in my life, but none of them recently. And Dayton did give me an award way back in, I think it was 1977, the John Chambers Award for the 12-foot dish and the parallel kilowatt amplifier. One of the years they gave me an award, and it was a year that I wasn't there. And they had brought in John Chambers' wife. He was a silent key, and they brought in John Chambers' wife to make the award presentation. And because of a mix-up, the award is kept secret. So therefore, nobody knew that in 1985 allowed me to watch NASA Select, the NASA direct broadcast between their individual NASA sites and the job site. So I could watch the raw data. And I remember on some of the early space shuttle launches, they were launching military hardware. And during those launches, they cut off the audio. Somehow the audio was being encoded. Couldn't hear what the astronauts were saying, but you could see the picture. So I saw pictures of some very exotic pieces of hardware carried up in the cargo hold of the space shuttle that was being launched. And most of those cases, there was some kind of a shroud over the hardware. Like, I'm guessing it was radio hardware, but what kind of antennas were inside of that shroud, you couldn't tell. Now, was the shroud there to make sure that as the astronauts maneuvered it, they wouldn't damage the elements of the antennas? Or was it there to keep secret what the actual spacecraft was and what it was doing? I'm not quite sure. But I do remember seeing some pretty wild pieces of hardware launched by the astronauts doing a spacewalk in the cargo hold of the space shuttle back in 1985, 86, 87, numbers like that. And even then, it seemed like approximately half the hardware that the space shuttle was bringing up into orbit. Let me drop it. It seemed to me like half the hardware was military and half the hardware was civilian. I'm pretty sure I do remember watching the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope. Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did watch that. And I know I was watching Billy Musgrove doing his repair. That was one hell of a repair. That mission, as you heard me say so often, was supposed to be two separate space flights. And he practiced and practiced and practiced where he's going to put his hand every second of the time. And him and all of his people managed to pull that off in one space flight. But boy, did he push it to the limit. He was out there way beyond the maximum time he's supposed to use the portable life support system. And on a couple of occasions, he came back into the airlock where he had run out of consumables. He had run out of oxygen, and he was on the emergency oxygen pack. And that ran out, and while he's in the airlock, he's now connecting the emergency hose from the airlock to his spacesuit to keep breathing. During part of that mission, he's out there during a spacewalk for numbers like 10 hours at a time. There for multiple orbits. Each orbit is 90 minutes. Let me drop this. So he's 40.
Deck, by the way. You win.
I win what?
I just found this on the NASA site. 1/3 of an inch thick. So each titanium wall is about 1 centimeter thick. But it's a lot bigger than I thought. Wow, I'm just looking at the size of this thing. Back to you, Dick.
Do they give you the dimensions of the box, Paul? Do they tell you how many feet wide, high, and long?
Yeah, each wall measures a square meter. And, wow. I mean, the whole thing is 500 pounds. I'm just looking. Physically, it looks like a big thing. I don't know, 4 feet by 4 feet. It looks like a big thing. You know, they got two guys standing next to this thing. But, I don't see that written down. But each titanium wall measures nearly square meters. How many walls? I guess it's six walls, right? Back to you, Dick.
500 pounds, empty or with the equipment?
Tom, good question. Any idea on that one, Paul?
There's something about the equipment. That's what I heard. What John said?
John wants to know, is it 500 pounds with the equipment inside, or is just the box 500 pounds?
The vault itself, the whole vault weighs 200 kilograms. That puts you at around, I always double it, a little bit more than that. 500 pounds is a good number.
Yeah, I think each kilogram is something like 2.2 pounds. So 220 kilograms, that what you said, Paul?
No, they have 200 kilograms. So pictures of it and with people working on it. Thank you, Dave.
Now, I know that there's a number of something like 10 million, and I think it was the ratio of the strength of the Jupiter-Van Allen belt versus the Earth-Van Allen belt. I know there's some kind of a ratio there of radiation of 10 million to 1. Do you remember anywhere where they told you how strong was the strength of the Jupiter-Van Allen belt? And that's what you got to protect from, and boy, can that tear up a spacecraft electronic something for your W-Pole.
I'll have to look for that one. I know inside the vault to the outside of the vault, this is on, you know, on one of my other websites. I remember reading 800 times different between the inside and the outside as it goes through the strongest part of the whole radiation belt. I was wondering myself, nobody brought it up, but why don't they use lead? And it shows here, it tells you in the NASA site, some people wanted to use lead, but they feel it's too soft to withstand the vibration of launch. It's just too soft. They need something more rigid like titanium. Back you there.
Yeah, with all the shake, rattle, and roll that vault is going to encounter, and a way of screwing down all of that hardware, you don't want to screw into lead. It's a very soft material. So titanium is a good choice of a material that doesn't rust, doesn't do anything bad, it's super strong. The only thing you're vulnerable with titanium is that it dissolves in chlorine. They found that out on the SR-71 when they're building it. People would make markings on the skin with a felt tip pen, and the chlorine that was in the fluid in the felt tip pen would eat into the surface of the titanium. Sometimes it ruins some very expensive, very hard to produce hardware. And the very special tooling that Lockheed had to come up with to make the pieces of the SR-71. Very special tooling was required. And when Congress wanted to make double darn sure that no more of these expensive airplanes would be built, no matter who wanted them, they ordered Lockheed to destroy all of that tooling. What a waste. Let me drop this. Because to this day, I mean, that aircraft had its origin approximately 1962 by Cully Johnson. So here we are, 54 years, let me think, 1962, 40, 50, yeah, we're 52 years downrange from the original creation of the A-12/SR-71 aircraft. And to some degree, nothing has come close to that performance yet, 50 years later. That's an airplane was really ahead of its time. At the bleeding edge, at Kelly Johnson, that's one hell of an aerodynamicist. And I've worked with a few people that met him. And I've worked with some of the pilots on the SR-71. Well, the reconnaissance officers. Not a pilot, but a reconnaissance officers. And boy, do they have some hair-raising stories to tell on some of the missions that they were on. That aircraft went to places it wasn't supposed to be and did things it wasn't supposed to be doing. And something like 5,000 surface-to-air missiles throughout its career. 5,000 individual surface-to-air missiles were shot at that airplane, and all of them missed. None of them came close. That's an airplane. When you can outrun bullets and missiles and whatever, and when you get the best possible gas mileage at 3.2 times the speed of sound at numbers like 80,000 feet, that's an airplane. Let me drop 35,000 pounds of thrust out of each one of those engines. And when you calculate that into horsepower at that speed and that force, it comes out with numbers like a quarter of a million horsepower per engine, chewing up fuel at the rate you wouldn't believe. I forgot the numbers. Okay. We're coming to the end of website. Here we go. Technet number 1609, as I said earlier. Next week, we're going to figure out how radio waves really work. I mean, I know there's a lot of magnetics involved. Here's a crazy question for you. Let me drop. You can take a permanent bar magnet and lay it on the table. And you lay a piece of paper on top. And you sprinkle iron filings on top of that piece of paper. and you will see the lines of force going from the North Pole to the South Pole of that magnet in the way those iron filings line themselves up. So there's something in between that North Pole and South Pole of that magnet. Magnetic lines of force. What is that made out of? Those magnetic lines of force are there if you're in air, if you're in a vacuum, if you're in helium, it doesn't matter. Those lines of force are there. What do they consist of? That's not an easy one. And every magnet is a bipolar device. You cannot make a unipolar magnet. And I think that's part of the reason why a magnetic field can go so far, like 12 billion miles. The majority of that signal coming from Voyager, it is my belief, it is a cyclic magnetic field. Let me drop. Okay, we've used up our time. Bye-bye, you all. I'm going to pass it over to John. And when you monitor the Echolink and IRLP website, roughly how many people were there, and from how many states or countries did you see your poll? I mean, John, KC2WGV, KC2RIW.
KC2WGV. It was a little light tonight. We had about 8 on Echolink, and we had 3 or 4 on the chat room. We got a very nice compliment from our northern people up in Canada. Said it was great net, and they really appreciated it. That was nice. And,
yeah.
It was a little light tonight. We've had as many as 13 on here at our maximum level, but it generally seems to be around between 9 and 10. So, well, tonight, considering the holiday, people are busy. But I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight and for the questions that were sent in. So, if everything goes well, we should be back next week. Have a nice 4 hours of fun. Good stuff. All right, gentlemen, wish everybody a great 4th of July and a safe 4th of July. Have fun and enjoy the hobby. KCWGB. Report.
And keep your fingers crossed for that Juno burn tomorrow night. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I think it's going to make it, man. There's a lot of safeguards. Dick, I sent you the email on that thing I was reading. It's a NASA email, so NASA website about the vault. And I'm going to go with photons around the around the magnet. I'll stick with photons for now. Back to you, Dick. 73, have a good night. Good night.
If they really were photons, Paul, you could use a camera to make a picture of them. I'm not sure it's photons, but that's a good guess. Bye-bye, you all. Take your eyes and be clear.
That's not my guess. I got that from some science documentary show. We'll see if they're right.
Someday we're going to know.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system.